welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about efforts by activists to get President Obama to commute more prisoners' sentences, prisoners of the drug war, before his term is done. But before we can move on, when the Flint water crisis hit, America was shocked at the massive levels of lead found in the water there, where literally tens of thousands were being poisoned every day. And now with criminal charges being levied against some Flint officials, attention is right back on the crisis. And a new investigation by Reuters shows that it's even worse than we thought nationwide. Reuters has identified 3,000 neighborhoods with lead levels at least double Flint's and 1,100 where lead levels are at least four times as high. In Warren, Pennsylvania, 36% of children had high lead levels, and in parts of Baltimore, Cleveland, and Philadelphia, 40 to 50% of all people in some neighborhoods had elevated lead levels in the blood, and a problem that appeared to stretch back across generations. And in fact, Pennsylvania had the most census tracts where over 10% of children showed elevated lead levels. Quote, in 49 different tracts from inner city Philadelphia to the capital Harrisburg, at least 40% of children tested at high lead, end quote. Many people had noted that Freddie Gray was killed by Baltimore police in a blockbuster case that led to an uprising in that city, that the neighborhood he came from was plagued by lead issues. And in fact, perhaps he had been poisoned as a child. According to Reuters, they more or less confirmed that the census tracts nearby where Freddie Gray is from had, quote, elevated lead levels were found in between 25 and 40% of children tested from 2005 to 2015, so pretty damning statistic there. And in Cleveland, the issue was so bad that the state health officials actually refused to even give the data to Reuters. They had to obtain it from the federal government. The report also noted that in Milwaukee last year, 11.5% of children tested had elevated lead levels, and in half a dozen depressed Northside census tracts, that's where the smaller uprising took place there in Milwaukee, about a third of the tests showed poisoning from 2010 to 2014, and 1 in 10 were highly elevated. And Reuters noted that, not surprisingly, many of these localities, just like Flint, are plagued by a legacy of lead, crumbling paint, plumbing, and industrial waste still being left behind. So really an unbelievably widespread problem related to America's terrible infrastructure. And just in case you weren't sure, the CDC wants to remind folks that lead for children is very dangerous. Lead poisoning, it can lead to severely affected mental and physical development. So really, this is a dangerous, devastating poison affecting tens of millions of people. And as we've reported, these things are just coming hot and heavy on the heels of each other as people look to learn what's going on. Chicago, just about a couple months ago, shut down hundreds of water fountains across the city after tests picked up elevated levels of lead in the water. And lead levels and 25% of city's water fountains actually exceeded the EPA action level of 15 parts per billion being contaminated. So lots of tricky situations there. Upstate New York, also huge issue. Fredonia, which is a school district in Fredonia in upstate New York, had so much lead in the water of some of the fountains in the schools they found, they were at 200 times the EPA action level. So all of this unbelievable stuff, tens of millions of people, including millions of children, being poisoned literally every single day. And Congress overall is spending $975 billion less than it would actually need to make the water infrastructure safe around the country for the next 25 years. Totally shocking state of affairs, and it really should outrage everyone. And there appears to be almost zero leadership from any major political figure on it. History absolutely will not absolve them of that. The Fraternal Order of Police that endorsed President-elect Donald Trump has released their blueprint for some of what they want him to do in the first 100 days, which is obviously a big deal, the first 100 days because of FDR's first 100 days. And as you might expect, it's not really good. You really have to just hear it to believe it. So I'm just actually going to read directly from their press release. It's pretty unbelievable. This is the Trump administration first 100 days, Fraternal Order of Police. Potential actions through executive order or action. Number one, very first thing, pledge to rescind Executive Order 13688, which imposed limits on state and local law enforcement equipment programs throughout the federal government. So in other words, let them get all of that military equipment they want, no matter what. Two, impose a restriction on some or all federal aid and grant programs to sanctuary cities. So anyone who's a sanctuary city, which is many of America's largest cities, cut off all federal aid to them. Local and state governments who are sanctuary cities, this is three, and those who may have granted documents like driver's license or other photographic identification which have names and addresses of persons unlawfully present in the U.S. may purge these databases so that they cannot be shared with federal government or law enforcement. So look at that. FOP also trying to protect some of their local law enforcement officers who may be ordered to do some of these deletions. But interestingly enough, in deferred action, this is for childhood arrivals, DACA, and using the federal database to identify those in the U.S. unlawfully, initiate their deportation. So if the cities want to delete it, you know, information about immigrants, great. But all those people who signed up for DACA, children now, who thought they were going to be able to stay in the country, just rescind that and use the information they give to sign up to deport them. Just deport children, many of whom were brought here, you know, almost as infants. The next one, in access to the U.S. from terrorist-prone areas where there's little confidence in the ability of immigration officials to conduct full vetting. So ban Muslims from America. That's what the U.S. cops think you should do. In the priority enforcement program at the Bureau of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, potentially restoring Project Safe Neighborhoods or a reprioritization of federal approach to immigration enforcement. And let me just go to the next one right after that, which expansion of the 287G program, which is actually the program that has local, state, and federal officials collaborate on deportation. So yes, calling for the federal government to put more money behind all levels of government collaborating to deport as many people as possible. Here's another one. Could reverse the change in U.S.-Cuba relations, perhaps until such a time as quote-unquote cop killers harbored there are returned to the United States. So shut down the U.S.-Cuba rapprochement until Assata Shakur is brought back. That's a big priority for the FOP. Deprioritize implementation of some or all of the recommendations made by the President's Task Force on 21st Century Policing. So every single potential reform proffered at all by the government under Barack Obama since he set up this task force to respond to what took place in Ferguson and the massive movement, Black Lives Matter, that swept the country, just deprioritize implementation, aka forget about all of that. Issue new directives to U.S. attorneys to prioritize violent crimes and seek the death penalty in federal cases involving the murder of a law enforcement officer. So a national Blue Lives Matter bill is what they're really proposing there. Direct, this is an interesting one, federal law enforcement agencies to not pursue violations of federal drug laws, even in states which have passed legislation legalizing the use, manufacture, and possession of marijuana. Okay, so that's okay. That's pretty good. That's one. But then they follow up with reverse the position of the federal government on the use of private prisons. Good for them. The Obama administration is already reversing their own position on that, as we have reported on this show. Next, they say reverse the executive orders. This is interesting. With respect to background checks for firearm purchases, the authority of the Social Security Administration to provide information on the mental health of its beneficiaries, funding and directed research for gun safety technology. And that last one was President Obama's idea that you should have the smart guns and only the person who owns it via a fingerprint should fire it. So the police don't believe any of that should maintain. Just get rid of background checks, get rid of safe guns. Really unbelievable. Reverse or amend the broad Bush-era ban on racial profiling by all or some federal agencies. So they threw one last one in there. They give you weed and they're against racial profiling. Everything else, though, get rid of Black Lives Matter, make sure anyone can own a gun, and give the cops tanks. And here we go. Before we end, they've got potential legislative initiatives on here, three of them. Here we go. Legislation entitled the, quote, End Illegal Immigration Act, end quote, to establish a two-year mandatory minimum federal prison sentence for illegally reentering the U.S. after a previous deportation, and a five-year mandatory minimum for illegally reentering for those with felony convictions, multiple misdemeanor convictions, or two or more prior deportation, and also reform visa rules to enhance penalties for overstaying. The second law they'd like to see passed would be entitled the, quote, Restoring Community Safety Act, to establish a task force on violent crime and increase funding for programs that, believe it or not, train and assist state and local law enforcement. So give them more federal dollars. And finally, and I don't even know how this got in there, legislation to repeal and possibly, not definitely, possibly replace the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, parentheses, Obamacare, which may end the impending, quote unquote, Cadillac tax that is slated to take effect in 2018. So maybe that's why they put it in there, because they've got really good health care in their contracts and they just don't want to get rid of it. So there you go. Fraternal Order of Police. That is what they want to see from the Trump administration first 100 days. Well, we'll see in the first 100 days how much their endorsement really was worth. And speaking of the police, New Orleans has reached settlements totaling $13 million to settle lawsuits related to deadly police shootings and actually a beating as well that happened right before Hurricane Katrina, but deadly police shootings in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. The cases involved were part of really an unbelievable set of actions by New Orleans police in the chaos following the hurricane. It included the shootings on the Danziger Bridge, where black people attempting to flee rising floodwaters were shot down in cold blood. Two were killed, four were wounded, and then they followed that up with a huge, massive cover-up. They planted a gun on a guy. They got false witnesses. They produced fabricated statements. They falsified the police reports. The whole nine. One of the men who died on the bridge was Ronald Madison. He's 40 years old. Had developmental disabilities. There was a whole back and forth. The five officers charged ultimately pled guilty. There was also the case of Henry Glover, who was shot outside a strip mall by police, one of whom then burned Glover's body in a car to try to cover up the fact that they just murdered him as well. And it's also worth remembering as we talk about this, as you know, every 28 hours, a black person is killed by police officer, security guard, or vigilante. That in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, there is also an explosion of racist vigilantes in an Algiers Point, the area in the Algiers section of New Orleans where this was most infamous. A group of roughly 30 white men formed a militia and shot 11 people, convinced that black residents fleeing the flood were criminals. Pretty disgraceful chapter in the history of this country. Thousands left to die, relief that never fully came, and a rebuilding effort that's focused more on charter schools and Disney-like tourist attractions than actually restoring the lives of many destroyed poor black communities. The settlement isn't justice, but at least it's now written down in history that these crimes happened and who perpetrated them. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are joined to continue our conversation with Jamal Muhammad, also known as DJ One Love. He's a promoter, he's a talk show host, and a visual artist. Jamal, thank you so much for joining the show.
Always, bruh. Always a pleasure, man.
Pleasure is all mine. I wanted to start here with the Fraternal Order of Police and what we were talking about a little bit there. I mean, you know, you got the whole sort of good cops, few bad apples thing that everyone talks about. But I mean, it really is pretty unbelievable to me that the police go around and say, yeah, we want to build bridges with the community. We want to do community policing and so on and so forth. And then not only is community policing not really a point in their whole thing, but I mean, most of it is just remilitarize the police, get rid of as many immigrants, ban a bunch of Muslims, bring back Assata Shakur, focus on giving the death penalty to people who shoot cops, repeal Obamacare. I mean, it just doesn't really seem that their public statements really are matched by their actual desires.
No, and you know what, Eugene, of all those that you just named, the fact is we need to stop glossing over this, is that all of those actions are reflective on impacting people of color. And that's just the truth about it. You know, I mean, even just Obamacare, Assata Shakur, Muslims, immigrants, everything is speaking to people of color. And that's the big pink elephant in the room that we're not addressing here. Because, you know, if you want to improve relations with the community, then you do so. You don't come up with all these heinous actions and irresponsible acts and lack of accountability and say, oh, we want to build a bridge with the community. The problem with the community that me and you know of is the stats that you said, that every 28 hours, a black person is either killed by the police or private security or some vigilante. That needs to be acknowledged. And we can't sit there and just say that this is all about crime prevention. because some of the crimes are manufactured, actually, not some, a lot of them, and then that affects the community, and that's what that deteriorates the bridge between the community and the police, because so many people, even good people in the community, don't trust the police because there are too many bad police officers. And not that they're all bad, but there are too many bad ones that have such a huge impact on the community because they have so much right that are in their favor whenever anything happens. If it's my word against the officer's word, well, my word doesn't exist. So you know, there's a bunch of hypocrisy here. And then with Donald Trump coming into office, everyone knows the truth, bro. You know, that, okay, people of color are already bracing themselves for a very cold next 4 years.
Mm, I think it's a good point. And the point you made about the officer's voice versus, you know, the people's voice, I think is so relevant, especially for black people in America with this New Orleans situation. I mean, that was 2005. And like now, right. Just in 2016, 11 years later, and like people have known about this for years, and there's this whole back and forth saga over all this different stuff. Finally, families are getting some sort of something. And it's just, honestly, the other thing it made me think of, to be quite frankly, was the Kanye, George Bush doesn't care about black people and how far he's come with now up in Trump Tower. But I mean, it's really crazy that this 11 years later, this, everything that happened in New Orleans, it's like it didn't happen. I mean, it really is.
You know, I was just in New Orleans back in the end of October, and I went down there part of the infectious diseases conference that I was helping to cover, and I had to do some interviews. And I went around the city just for my own sake to see with my own eyes the difference. And I interviewed several people. I interviewed a homeless couple, actually. You know, I asked them what happened to, you know, what can they recount what happened when the levees broke and the whole flooding and everything. And they told me how chaotic it was and how painful it was because the lady, she had to go to Tampa, Florida, and the gentleman, he had to go to Houston, Texas for about 3 months. And when he came back, his father and his sister had died from everything.
Mm.
And which was just, you know, it was just hard to hear him say that. You know, he lost his father and his sister. And you know, just going around talking to people, talking about how different it is now. So, you know, it's been 11 years, but there is so much displacement within the black community down there now. And, you know, I went down there to see what was actually the difference between now and then. And they told me, I mean, it's become Disneyland like for the tourists and even, you know, for the gentrifiers. Meanwhile, the majority of the black people that have been displaced, a lot of them are not coming back. And the ones who have come back, their neighborhoods are gone.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same story around the country, but it's a bit worse with New Orleans because you have such a high concentration of black people and so much rich history.
Sure. Well, we're going to have to take a quick break on that point, but we're going to come back with more here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, I'm your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. And we are continuing our conversation here with Jamal Muhammad. And, you know, one area I wanted to raise here that I thought is extremely relevant to, you know, sort of both of the examples we're just giving about the police and what they are doing and what they're not doing. And honestly, reflecting on the New Orleans thing, too, you have so much conversation. And the report is about to come out. I mean, it already has come out, but it's not going to make big news probably until the first of the year on the Brennan Center of Justice thing on crime in America. I guess what it's going to say, they've only sort of pre-released it, is that in a handful of major cities, murder rate is up. And so there's this whole scare now around black-on-black crime again. And, you know, just the whole conversation. And I'm thinking like, okay, sure, in many places it is an issue, but then it's like tens of millions of people are being poisoned by lead.
Right.
I mean, so many other issues that are existing. Like, how is this like, oh, well, just, yeah, you just ignore all this, and if these people would just stop killing each other, as if that isn't just sort of nested in the context of everything else happening in these communities.
Well, you know, it's interesting because the U.S., I'm going to say the U.S. government in particular, for the last, I would say, 3 or 4 administrations have have increased the amount of fear-mongering, focusing on certain issues and then amplifying those issues while ignoring so many others. So you take the whole lead water issue that's been going on, which this didn't just happen overnight, Eugene. I mean, we all know about Flint, but people here in D.C. have been complaining about the lead levels in the D.C. public schools for a long time. And as a matter of fact, the more press that got out there about Flint, the more people in D.C. were saying, whoa, we actually have it even worse here. And then you bringing up Chicago, other cities across the country. And you don't hear anything about that in the media. You don't hear anything about that from the government. And these are atrocious numbers that we're looking at now that the studies are coming to find out. But you'll hear about black and black crime. And even the label, it's such as black and black crime, is fear-mongering and targeting black people, because we already know for a fact that the statistics show that people are more likely to kill someone of their own race that looks like them than they are of another race. Mm. So why do we label it as black on black crime? You know, we don't label, white kids or white adults killing each other as white on white crime, or Asians who doing it to themselves as Asian on Asian crime. But we label it as black on black crime because that puts more fear out there into white society and to even to just America as a whole, that, oh, these black people just don't know how to contain themselves, and we need to put more money into fighting crime and into the militarization of our policing to control this outrageous number. And, of course, Chicago has become the epicenter of anything when it comes to black people and crime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's always the example of Chicago, as if you don't have problems anywhere else around the country. But it also, we're ignoring the amount of crime that has come up lately from the addictions to methamphetamines, crystal meth, and into heroin within in white homes. And that's increased exponentially. And we're not talking about any of that. And if you just pay attention and look at, you'll see more and more younger white males out there that are homeless because of these addictions. Take the city of Baltimore. I have a friend who's a doctor up there at Johns Hopkins, and she told me it has become outrageous, the epidemic of white males addicted to heroin and crystal meth. And with drugs comes crime, but it's being swept under the rug. So, you know, it they pick their poisons on what they wanted to project out there to scare the daylights out of people. Mm-hmm. And then they ignore a lot of other things that are actually more tragic and more that need a more sense of urgency to be addressing, such as the lead issue.
Right, right. Well, the lead issue, I mean, it just speaks to the role of the media. I mean, and you look at all these situations. I mean, because I'm glad you brought up the issue with D.C. The same dude who revealed the Flint thing, the professor from Virginia Tech, also was revealing in 01, 02, 03 talking about D.C., and it didn't get exactly the same level of attention. And I think, you know, as much as Flint deserved to be out there, it's an easier story for the media, you know, because they can tie it into the whole, you know, Rust Belt, America collapsing, whatever.
Right, exactly.
It's not the same story, and it's an easy story for them, and it kicked it off. Same thing with the criminal justice issue. I mean, the other thing that I often think of is, I mean, no one, like, if the media was saying every day that, like, it's actually more dangerous to be a taxi driver than a cop, people, which is true.
Right.
Most people would say, like, think totally different things. But it's like, you hear police are the most prevalent, whatever. Every TV show or movie about prisons, it's just like a bunch of people knifing each other and raping each other every 30 seconds.
Yeah.
I mean, just like, you know, these crazy views that people have, and some of it's sensationalism, some of it's fiction. I mean, it's not all necessarily like directly designed to mislead people, but then on a certain level, you have to start to think, at what point does the news, the media, and the entertainment industry have to really come more under the microscope for setting the agenda of these discussions on so many different ways by establishing the baseline of what people believe is happening?
You know, there's what, approximately, I believe, what, 33,000 police officers in the U.S., and annually about 150 police officers die every year. And out of that 150 annually, 50 of them die from interaction with a chase, like car accidents or something, car crashes and things like that. Another 50 die from self-inflicted wounds or heart attacks or something like that. And then the other 50 die from actually being murdered by civilians. Not that we want any death, but that's not a lot compared to some of the other atrocious issues we have. I mean, you could just take take mental health in America as an issue. You can take physical ailments such as diabetes, heart disease, cancer, suicide. There's way more people committing suicide than there are police in the country. And that's not a public interest, and even looking at reentry from the military, how many people come back and commit suicide. We don't talk about that enough, yet we will highlight when a cop is killed, an officer is killed by an individual out there in the city or in the streets or so forth, as if, okay, this is the greatest danger. Meanwhile, you have more construction workers dying than police officers every year.
Right. By order of magnitude. And I mean, you know, the thing it also makes me think of is, I mean, how could anyone possibly be shocked that huge numbers of people didn't vote, that less people, especially in inner city black communities, didn't vote? Because there's really like two separate conversations. I mean, it's like the political conversation that everyone's having where, and I think to me, this is, people say that they ignored Hillary Clinton, she ignored the community, blah, blah, blah. She didn't ignore the community. I feel like almost if she had ignored it, more people might have actually voted because they would have felt like, well, at least I'm going to try to get myself in the discussion. But I felt that it was that they addressed it, but they address it so ridiculously and so out of touch with what's going on and so mediated through the lens primarily of preachers at the elite level in these cities that it's even more of a turnoff than being ignored, because it's like, well, you're talking to me, but you're not listening to me.
Yeah, you know, I watched her campaign and I got disgusted because I saw the same rhetoric going over and over again, in which it was the same to the inner city black people and also suburban blacks, but especially inner city black people. It was the same noise being heard and over again. And it became pandering to a certain extent, to the point where a lot of people, when I talked about it, you know, and even on my show, that people have expressed that it's like, we're tired of hearing the same thing. Okay. Nothing is changing. You had 8 years of an Obama administration in which we've seen more and more black people being killed by police. And yet you're telling me that you're going to come in, it's going to be different. And I think it got to the point where now it's like, okay, I don't see why it's worth it. You know, I voted for Obama twice, and yet, you know, we've seen more cops get off. You know, I voted for Obama. I voted for Bill Clinton when he first came in his two terms, and not much has changed for the black community, so why should I vote again? I think that's what the mindset has been for a lot of black people. I'm not saying that that's right or, you know, justified. I'm saying that this is what people have been speaking of, and that they just honestly don't trust the political structure anymore. You know, and I think that's one of the reasons why Trump was able to get in, because he wasn't part of the political structure that the norm that you've seen. So it's just something different, but. Yeah, I just think people just don't trust them anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's we're seeing that with all institutions, the media, the politicians, the institutions of the politicians, the Congress. I mean, really at all time lows in terms of people trusting them. I mean, to some degree, I mean, I talk to a lot of people who vote who have also lost all trust and all just complete whatever. And I think this is only going to be worse. I mean, it seems that the combination, I mean, as ridiculous as the whole quote-unquote Russia hack story was, I think the end result of that plus the voter suppression, I mean, it really in some ways is ironic, because they're saying like, oh, well, Russia was trying to do it to undermine the U.S. elections. But, I mean, they're doing it themselves by saying how easily the U.S. election, if this was true, were easily undermined. I mean, that in and of itself, plus the voter suppression, plus the sort of, you know, back and forth on the recount and people feeling like things weren't really checked correctly, plus the Electoral College, that really the whole post-election period has done maybe more than the campaign itself to undermine people's trust in the quote-unquote democracy in America. I mean, it seems like perhaps we're entering a whole new phase where that kind of like traditionally in America, that was like the sacrosanct thing, where maybe that's not the case anymore.
Yeah, I think the old ways of doing things are starting to fall off, and the newer generations just they just don't. They're looking at it, that like it's a relic, like watching Happy Days or something. Mm. And with the impact that social media has had, you know, people are a lot more open and have a lot more information readily right there at hand for them to look and investigate on things themselves than they did in the past. And you know, before social media exploded, you had to take what the mainstream media gave you, unless you've done your own deep research and going to libraries and going to special seminars of people speaking and things, you know, that are countering the government. And, but now all you got to do is say, you know, use search engine and or YouTube or something, and you can look up information that for decades had been hidden from you. And I think it's changed a lot of people's opinions, man. Mm-hmm. Especially a lot of younger people.
No, you know,
my son is 24, and he has a whole different perspective on things. He's a 24-year-old student at Morgan State, and you know, he tells me about what his friends are talking about, and it's completely different from what my friends were talking about back in the 90s when we were at, you know, the same age as him.
I think that definitely a lot of sort of the hope of that, especially in the Black community, sort of certain 80s, even early 90s of people feeling like they could, you know, escape a little bit more or whatever, or maybe have more opportunity, as opportunity in general for all college graduates or whatever has faded in this country. A lot of that has just completely gone away. I mean, it's just so inane on so many levels too, because you hear so many of like the pieces, like, you know, this year, the report that came out about how income inequality was worse than we even thought it was. You know what I mean? You're hearing all these different pieces. Like, to me, one of the most interesting parts of the whole WikiLeaks Podesta thing was when someone sent him that study from 2013 from Princeton that was like, America's an oligarchy, not a democracy. And his response to the person who sent it to him was, wow, we needed a study to prove what everyone knows. So like, the level of cynicism is so high. Like, this dude in his private emails is like, yeah, the democratic system in America is completely controlled by billionaires. They get whatever they want. That's 100% obvious. And then you go out into the media and you support a candidate who's trying to say that that's not really the case. And then you get caught saying it and you get mad that someone revealed it. I mean, it's just like, how can you have all the facts out there and then have a conversation around politics or economics or social issues in this country that then happens without any of these things being considered factors?
Yeah. You know, I'm eager to see how these next 4 years are going to go with all of this, because I, like I said, the traditional processes that have been put in place of how we run our government and how we control the masses they've weakened tremendously. This new generation of people, there's just too much competition from other sources because of the internet to counter the stereotypical ways. I think within the next 20 years, you're going to see a major shift and how this country is operated. And I don't know. I can't tell you, brother, what's going to happen, but I do know that it's going to change. And, you know, the old ways of thinking and doing things, you know, it's become obvious to people. Like you said, you don't need to tell me, you know, do a study for me to know that corporations run this country. You know, and then with this new administration coming in, that's even further proof. I mean, he's got people that he's looking to put on and staff that have no credential whatsoever to run their departments. I mean, the lady who he picked for running for education, I mean.
Yeah, Betsy DeVos, who also had a husband who ran for governor of Michigan and was trying to bring intelligent design back in the schools. Well, maybe if we needed a sign from the universe about what was coming, for those who may, you know, be interested in the movements of celestial bodies, tonight is the first solstice lunar eclipse in 500 years, which means that tonight will be the longest, darkest night in 500 years. So perhaps the universe is sending us some sort of message. I don't know what to say.
Wow.
Oh, man, I know. I unbelievable that is actually the case. Shout out to my man, Jed Bracey in New Hampshire, who brought that to my attention. Yeah, it's kind of everything you need to know about what's going on. Even the universe feels it and sees it. But yeah, I mean, what I will say though, in terms of things moving forward is maybe, cause to some degree it's negative, but to some degree it maybe is positive. I mean, like, maybe there is sort of a creative destruction aspect in all of this, that like the whole thing kind of has to collapse. You know, the temple kind of has to fall down on itself for people to even wake up to the need to rebuild. Like, maybe you can't even just keep patching the holes. Maybe it needs to fall down for people to wake up. I don't know.
You know, I agree with you on that. And that's why I'm very optimistic, because, you know, they say it's always darkest, before dawn, before the light comes up. And the information you gave is like, whoa, it don't get any darker than that.
Right.
But I think that it needs to implode in order for us to rebuild. You know, we have great assets about this country. There are a lot of great things, but it's been so much crookedness since day one that was always ignored and not held accountable, that has always stopped us from progressing to be the great country that we claim to be. We're not that country that we claim to be, and we've been living off of that lie for a very long time. I remember back in 1992, a buddy of mine from college up in Pittsburgh went overseas, and he just traveled over to Europe and into North Africa and the Mediterranean areas. And he was surprised at how many people didn't like him because he was American. And this was 1992. When he came back, he was like, man, we're not liked as much as we think we are, because so many other people from other countries have been telling us we're arrogant, we think we know everything, and we try to tell everybody what to do as if these other countries hadn't had history and we, you know, before we came along. And that always stuck with me, because now you're seeing a change. You know, the country is more diverse when it comes to race and religion, and yet you still see the same practices put in place that aren't accommodating that diversity. I don't know what these people who want to get rid of these so-called illegal aliens think is going to happen. If we were to get rid of every so-called illegal alien, in particular the Latino ones, is what they're focusing on, them in the Caribbeans, this country's economy would implode. I mean, let's be honest. My brother used to be a manager for McDonald's Corporation, and he told me, if we got rid of all the illegals and, you know, that were here, the undocumented, McDonald's would go out of business, because there'd be nobody there to work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't be the only one. Well, I'll tell you what. I think it's a good point for sure. We got to end, unfortunately, on that point. But that was Jamal Muhammad, host of the Love Lounge, also known to many of us as DJ One Love. We're going to be back with more with Dr. Madeline McClinney Sadler, talking about President Obama and commutations here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about some of the news surrounding President Obama's commutation of 153 prison sentences this week, adding on to a process he's been pushing forward here for some time, and towards the end of his presidency for sure, to potentially lessen the impact of the war on drugs. And we are joined by the Reverend Dr. Madeline McClinney Sadler, who's the president and founder of the Exodus Foundation that does quite a bit of work on this issue. Dr. Sadler, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you for having me. It's always good to be back. And you can just call me Dr. Madeline.
Well, I appreciate that. And the pleasure is all mine, Dr. Madeline. And so here we are. Obama commuted 153 more sentences this week. He's getting a lot of sort of praise on this issue for commuting more sentences than ever. What is your analysis? Has he gone far enough? Too far? What's going on?
You know what? He's done great compared to other administrations. Yet, Eugene, it's still a drop in the bucket. And when you think about the thousands of people that are being left behind, it's not enough. And I know he can do more. And we want him to do more. We want him to go big and bold. And we have submitted an Exodus plan to the White House for his consideration. And we need everyone listening to your show to call the White House at 202-456-1111 and say, please meet with the Exodus Coalition.
Yes, I think that's absolutely critical. I think this is a big push here, and I think it's one where sort of pushing has already gotten us somewhere, so perhaps can get us even further. I mean, what do you think the biggest hang-up is? I mean, I remember when Eric Holder first came out talking about this, he said as many as maybe 10,000 people would be released and not on track to do anything close to that. I mean, what's the hang-up here in the Obama White House about why they're not getting more people out here?
This is speculation, but it's based in, you know, some of the conversations I'm hearing around town, and I think there's a general concern about public safety, and so the criteria themselves indicate that when you ask if someone, you know, has should serve 10 years of a sentence before even applying for commutation, that says something about the fact that even the clemency process has a punitive piece to it, you know, that you can have no infractions, no serious infractions, and the infractions should be expected while you're in prison, and, you know, you're in a jungle trying to survive, and that you'd be able to demonstrate that if you were sentenced today, your sentence would be dramatically reduced. Mm. So the Exodus Coalition plan is a plan for increasing the number of federal prisoners eligible for clemency before President Obama leaves office. Eugene, it offers a new set of criteria for clemency and a method for identifying those who meet those criteria on a case-by-case basis over a short period of time. So, for example, Loretta Lynch has said recently that there's not going to be any blanket commutation, that they're not going to get rid of, you know, individual screening. Well, our plan includes individual screening post this administration. So what we're asking the president to do and say, I hereby commute the sentences of, you know, all federal prisoners who meet the criteria of the Exodus plan. Then we go in, you know, collaboratively with the right department in the government and with our partner, UNC Charlotte Criminal Justice Department scholars, and identify who met our criteria. So in other words, real simple, President Obama says, everyone with a red jacket on, I'm commuting your sentence. We go in and we find everybody with a red jacket on.
Mm. Well, I mean, that seems like kind of the smartest way to do it. And you know, one of the other things that I think is relevant about this issue of sort of the quote-unquote blanket commutations and just the way it's presented is, you know, I mean, this concept that, like, the only thing that could happen if there's a quote-unquote blanket commutation is, like, a bunch of, you know, dangerous animals get released on the street is sort of the way it's played. But, I mean, there are examples from around the world, if I'm not mistaken, of very large-scale reentry efforts that have been successful, but that doesn't really get that much in the conversation here. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, what you have some examples in our own country. You know, Abraham Lincoln and Andrew Johnson commuted the sentences, pardoned, you know, some say millions of Confederate soldiers and sympathizers. So it's not like the president would be setting a precedent. In Rwanda, you have the reconciliation process after the genocide, where close to 50,000 people were freed over a 2-year period. And we're talking people who were engaged in genocide to one extent or the other. In this case, we're talking about nonviolent and overcharged persons and people in the cage matter. Their lives matter. Caged lives matter. And so it's unacceptable that this happened on our watch. These men and women, many of them will die in prison and continue to waste away in health and mental health if we don't do something right now.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's 100% clear. I mean, it seems like we're going into such a unknown zone here, you know, sort of post January 20th. I mean, whatever Obama has or has not done, I feel like we at least have some sense of what the sort of parameters are and where the debate is. But I mean, do you get any sense of with the incoming Trump administration? I don't know. My assumption, obviously, is that they will do nothing on this issue. But I know there's been some Republicans in Congress that haven't been the worst of the worst on this. So is it possible that the efforts here towards the end of the Obama administration could actually set us up for more success moving forward? Or is it going to be, this is sort of a last bite at the apple for some time for a significant number of folks to get out?
Well, so, you know, I think we have to live and advocate as if it's the last bite of the apple, because we don't know what's to come. And we're talking about people's relatives and loved ones whose lives are on the line. At the same time, you know, we're nonpartisan. Our thrust is 24-hour reentry mentoring. But we were moved, I was moved by vision to serve in this way and this advocate in this way, because this is a historic moment in this presidency, and we can't let this pass without pushing Obama and giving him the strength, strengthening his hand to do more. I'm expecting some surprises from the next administration. You know, Paul Ryan has said, rather than lock people up, why don't we unlock their potential? Mm. You know, that's the Speaker of the House, Republican Speaker of the House. So as a nonpartisan organization, we're reaching out to, you know, both sides of the aisle to get support. And there's growing bipartisan support. But, you know, the thing is, because the nation can't afford this, you know, this is what's going to, this can sink, this whole mass incarceration piece is not only inhumane, but it will financially sink our economy, mm-hmm. if we continue to do this. You know, we've got, you know, so many issues around it that need to be addressed. But this is the first one, and the president doesn't need the approval of Congress. And guess what? It can't be reversed.
Mm-hmm. No, very good point. Very good point. And, you know, the other thing I wonder, too, in terms of conceiving the importance of this moment is, and it's strange that somehow this never gets talked about, but I mean, you know, whatever the truth of this, and I think it's mostly dubious, there's all this sort of propaganda out there about a crime wave and quote unquote black on black crime and all that stuff we normally hear. But what we also know from many academic studies done on violence interrupter programs is that people re-entering communities coming out of prison have been playing an unbelievable role in communities around the country in reducing levels of violence on their own through, you know, some government run programs. I mean, it really is an interesting way. And I just wonder how important that narrative is moving forward of, like, you know, healing communities to so many degrees, you know, ending mass incarceration. I think rather than sort of the effect that it's consistently put, oh, it's just going to put a bunch of quote unquote criminals back on the street, seems like it might be one of the ways to start to unlock how do we deal with some of these entrenched problems of communal violence that communities, black communities, are facing as well.
I'm so glad you raised that, because the solutions to many of our problems are locked up in those walls. And so the answers are there. You hit the nail on the head. The men and women coming out are going to be some of the most highly motivated and capable people of helping to share their life lessons with the young people and people, you know, who are making decisions that are destructive to themselves and their communities. So it's a win-win. And how can we live with ourselves if we justify holding tens of thousands of people in a cage because, you know, 100 may reoffend?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's just no justification for that.
Right.
Especially when you have so many people, you know, there's so many disparities in the system anyway. People that have never been to prison who committed crimes, people whose cases are dismissed, who did 6 months for rape and never saw more than a few months in jail or prison or whatever. And so the disparities are just mind-boggling. And we will save $21 billion over a 10-year period if as many people as we suspect are eligible under our criteria.
Wow. Huge impact. Well, let me ask you this before I go to one other broad question. I know that you guys are pushing now, and on January 5th, you have got a big push starting to sort of supercharge this effort. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you and Exodus will be doing starting then.
You know, I hope it doesn't have to come to that, but it's what I believe in and what I'm led to do. So if we have not heard anything affirmative in terms of a meeting with the White House, or the adoption of the Exodus Coalition Plan, or something better. And by the way, Eugene, our plan has been endorsed by over 30 national agencies and individuals and organizations. And so, you know, we've got the National Council of Churches, the Ecumenical Poverty Initiative, Barbara Arnwine, lots of groups on board. And so on January 5th, if we don't have an affirmative response in our direction, I will begin a hunger strike and escalate in terms of its severity as we get closer to midnight on January 20th, which is the very last hour in which you can do something.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly we hope that before that, that you do not have to do it. And hopefully folks here who are listening call the White House and demand that meeting. I think it's the, at the very least what they could do. But, you know, it also just raises a whole other question for me and how we sort of frame this and how we look at this. And something that I think we're sort of walking into is whether or not our whole paradigm around how we treat quote-unquote so-called crime is totally twisted and turned around. I mean, we talk so much about, you know, the remedies for X and Y and Z, but we never talk about, I think, in a lot of this conversation, the root of this, which is sort of this punitive carceral idea where it's like, well, either we put people in prison less or we put people in prison more, but there's never any sort of fundamental questioning of whether or not we even have a system that is designed to address these major problems in our society. I wonder what you think about that.
No, we don't. We don't. And it's so ironic that we're in a Judeo-Christian nation and those two major faiths discuss a nation that claims that the founding, and it is the heritage that out of which much of our jurisprudence grows. So that we're so unmerciful, right? That we're so punishment oriented. And here we are, you know, in the week of a major holiday where the celebration of the birth of redemption into the world is part of that ritual that we recognize, that we are so hesitant to redeem one another. We're so hesitant to behave in redemptive and merciful ways.
Mm.
And that just speaks volumes against us and our, you know, hypocrisy, you know, as a whole. You know, people have asked you, Gene, you know, you got 20-something, you got 30 days left. You know, is it worth it? Do you have enough time? There's some groups that will be retreating from clemency. We're hitting the accelerator. Again, I can't stress enough how important it is that your listeners think about the fact that these are human lives that are on the line. In the playoffs this year, in the championship game this year, Ryan Arcia-Diacono passed the ball to Chris Jenkins, and they won the championship in 4.7 seconds, right? It changed the whole game around. That's all we need, Eugene. We need those 4.7 seconds for him to sign an order saying, I hereby grant clemency to everyone who meets the Exodus Coalition plan criteria. And then we go to work with the scholars at USC Charlotte over the next 5 years and identify who met those criteria. So there are people whose sentences he's commuted that won't even get out for 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years.
Wow.
So this is what we're proposing is not anything out of the ordinary or unusual.
Well, I just want to hit on that really quickly. How is that even possible that you could have your sentence commuted and then still be in there for a number of, I mean, I kind of figured if you had your sentence commuted, you just kind of walked out the next day.
Yes. And that's what people don't understand. No, that is not what's happening. So for a few people, yes, they're getting out 6 months to a year after they get the notification that their sentence has been commuted. And for others, they may have a 40-year sentence and they're 10 years into it, and the White House Office of Pardons reduces it by 10 years. So they still got another 20 years to go. You know, one gentleman in particular that we advocated for has served over 12 years, maybe even 15 years of a life sentence for having less than 3 ounces of cocaine. First of all, he shouldn't have done. I am not a prison advocate in any way, so I would have wanted this person to be in treatment. But let's, for the sake of argument, 5 years max. He's done 12 years, and he still has to wait until 2018 to get out.
Mm.
So under our plan, a prisoner is eligible for clemency if they're nonviolent or overcharged. For example, a nonviolent charge, they have a nonviolent charge and have served at least 3 years of their sentence. Mm. Now, people with weapons offenses aren't even considered under the current criteria. And under our criteria, you have a weapons offense wherein the weapon was not used in the crime, but it added 10 to 15 years in your sentence. So they stop you for the drugs, but they find a gun in your trunk. So you not only get the 10 years for the drugs, if it's your third strike or whatever the case may be, you get an additional 10 or 15 years because you had a weapon in your car and you had a previous felony. So you're a felon with a weapon. So people are overcharged. And those prisoners are not even having their applications considered. They don't even meet the criteria to even be considered. People who have been guilty by association, you know, the police round everybody up on the corner for conspiracy, and you're with the group that day, and so, or for whether it's a conspiracy to sell drugs or a murder, you're not the trigger man, and everybody gets charged with murder. Everybody gets charged with conspiracy. Our criteria says that anyone attributable to whose guilt is attributable by association and has served at least 1 year would be eligible for clemency. People who are not American citizens are eligible under our plan. People who have been classified as seriously violent are eligible to make their case on why their case was not handled properly and be considered for clemency. People who are over 59 and have served at least 15 years of their sentence are eligible.
Mm. I mean, to me, that just makes the most sense. I mean, it just sort of seems like even when people talk about quote-unquote serious violent crimes, I mean, the idea that somehow, like, if you do something once, you can never change is just shocking to me, and how sort of – and it's one of those things that I feel like almost no person would ever apply sort of in, like, their average daily life for someone who they knew well. But when you don't know someone, you know, you're way more likely to just sort of say, well, this person did X and they did Y and they're never going to change, and lock them up and throw away the key and this, that, and the third. But it just doesn't even seem relevant. But great conversation. It's so great that we're actually running up on the end of the time here for this. But of course, the Exodus Foundation is doing a lot of work around this. Go to their website, check them out, call the White House, do whatever you can to support this effort to get more people out. Dr. Madeline, thank you so much for joining the show. And that is going to do it for today's show here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. See you next time.
By any means necessary.